thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 76 for Friday, November 4th, 2011. Siri, how do I fix academic publishing? Well, welcome to another edition of Digital Campus. By my count, this is Digital Campus number 76. We're recording right at the very beginning of the month of November. And with us are all the usual folks. We have Dan Cohen from dancohen.org. Where are you, Dan?
I'm in my office at Dan Cohen Central.
Dan Cohen Central. Very good. Very good. And then we have Amanda French from amandafrench.net. Amanda, are you also in the vicinity of Dan Cohen Central?
Yes, I am. I am on the margins of Dan Cohen Central. I'm orbiting Dan Cohen.
All right. All right. And then Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org. And Tom, you're a displaced person, if I remember correctly.
Yes, I'm a refugee in Massachusetts. No, it's not all that bad. People haven't heard, the Northeast, the far Northeast, New England had a big snowstorm over the weekend, and we've been without power. This is 6 days and counting, so I'm staying with family in Massachusetts and trying to stay warm. So, I'm in the farthest orbit of Dan Cohen, so the Kuiper Belt, let's say, of Dan Cohen.
Yes, and I am.
We won't decommission you from the orbit like Pluto.
Right, demote me to.
Demote.
Non-planetary.
A minor iced planet.
Large asteroid.
Pretty much what you are in 25 below Connecticut right now.
So, and I'm Nils Kelly from Edward.org, and I am in just one of the, I guess, not exactly an inner orbit of Dan Cohen Central, but in the next county over. So I don't know exactly where that puts me, but I'm a lot closer than frozen Connecticut. So we tried to get a special guest on the podcast today, but unfortunately, he or she, I've never been quite sure which he or she is, was just really unwilling. This would be Siri from the new iPhone 4S. I tried to get her on and she wouldn't come on, so then I tried to get him on and he wouldn't come on either. So instead, we're going to have to ask the folks on the podcast what they think about the advent of this new talk to your phone phenomenon for the digital humanities. Dan, Amanda, either of you have an opinion on this?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we've seen technologies like this for a while, and my sense is, if you've tracked, for instance, even fairly early on, I don't know if people remember the AOL instant messaging bots that sometimes would come around that were using, you know, kind of an early version of the back end of this conversational technology. In fact, there's some open source versions of these things where you can set up, and indeed we did set up one at the center to run in the background for HBot, our little historical knowledge bot, so that when you ask it questions, if you went off topic, it would answer from this database of sort of pithy quotes and sort of funny retorts and things like that.
I miss HBot, by the way.
Yeah, well, anyway, so, you know, but obviously I think what's particularly interesting about this development is, you know, in the same way that, for instance, Newton and handwriting recognition kind of came along too early, it seems like some of this, the voice recognition technology has gotten a lot better. If you've ever used Dragon's dictation software, which I do have on my iPhone, and my sense is they're actually using that for the transcription of your voice part of it, not the artificial intelligence part. But it is remarkably good. I've dictated, emails, and I'm always surprised at how much it gets right. So clearly, the voice recognition stuff has gotten hugely better in the last 5 years. And so that's one piece that's coming together. And I think the other piece is this artificial intelligence aspect. And there's two things going on there. One is a whole field of computer science that, again, has taken a major leap forward, which is generally called QA or Q&A, question and answering, where there's a whole bunch of software algorithms for understanding what a human being is asking for and then trying to figure out how to answer it. And having very large data sets that you can answer natural language queries with. So the biggest one, for instance, that they're using is Wolfram Alpha, the awfully named and almost impossible to pronounce Wolfram Alpha, where they can answer factual data using, for instance, the CIA Factbook or World Book database of information. So if you ask it what the population of Venezuela is, it understands what you're saying. It goes out to that database, it retrieves the answer, and then it speaks it back to you. The other piece of it, which I do think is kind of interesting for the listeners to this podcast, is that it's location aware. And that's where I think things get really interesting. And I'd love to hear the views of the other regulars on this. But I am intrigued by, well, first of all, I mean, I'm not going to go out and buy a 4S. Like, I will wait another year to get a new phone. But I do a lot of things where I have to remind myself about that. And a lot of it is location-based. So, you know, when you get to the office, be sure to talk to, you know, Amanda about X or Y. And that piece of it, the fact that it can know where your workplace is and when you get there, send a reminder, I think is pretty neat. And I think that fact suggests some really interesting possibilities for education, in particular, the fact that, let's say, students walking around, you know, in a historic battlefield out near you in Manassas could get Siri enhanced discussions just kind of based upon where they move. I don't know. I mean, it kind of opens up a creative possibility. But I think these three things combined are what we should be thinking about, that it's location aware, it's question and answer aware, and it has very high accuracy voice dictation. I think all those things coming together in one package is kind of what makes it new and different than, you know, although people are saying, oh, well, things like this have existed before. I think all those things coming together in a consumer package is rather interesting.
Yeah, right? Go ahead, Tom.
I agree with Dan. I mean, I think that none of this is actually tremendous in itself. None of these features are tremendously groundbreaking. The voice recognition, as Dan said, like Android has it. I dictate emails and text messages all the time. Even the location aware reminders, I think, combining it with the natural speech is sort of new, but there are services that will, you know, remind you, you know, of, you know, give you a notification about your grocery list when you walk into the grocery store, that kind of thing. But as with all Apple products, I mean, it's the integration of these things. It's the UI that makes it a little more interesting. And I think that's really the tough nut to crack with these kinds of voice services, voice recognition services. It's not the technology, actually. I think that's the big barrier at this point. It's the social aspects that are the tough ones to crack. I saw a great quote in Popular Mechanics. One of their writers, John Herman, said that the problem with Siri is that in public it's rude and in private it's creepy. And I think that really kind of gets at it. It's not so much that these are tough technological problems to solve. It's that talking to your phone is kind of weird. And it's just we're not socialized to do it. And so that, I think, is the big question with Siri. Can they get the service, can they get the kind of feel of it right? Can they get the social aspects of it right to make people want to actually do it? It could be like so many other things, a great piece of technology that doesn't get used because it doesn't fit into the way, you know, our ways of living, our ways of working. So that's my big question: is this something people are actually going to do?
Yeah, I think when I first saw some of the ads for this, I thought, right away, I could think of some great applications in museums. So because of the location awareness, and so I'm standing in front of a painting that I really like. And so I say to my phone or whatever device gets developed with a similar technology, I really like this. Can you suggest something else? You know, is there something else in the museum by this painter? Or what else should I be looking at? Or, you know, something like that, that might guide me through. Or are there other works painted at the same time or in the same city? Or are there other, you know, if it's a landscape, are there other views of this same location? And so then the phone can quickly suggest to me somewhere else to go in the museum.
But like, so that's the problem. Yeah. Like, how rude is it? Like, how you know, you're standing, you know, admiring this, you know, Vermeer, and everybody's phones are talking to them. You know, I mean, it's annoying, right? It's rude. So that's the question: is can they work? Can we work out the, you know, and maybe we just become a ruder society and a louder society. But I just wonder if we can. The sociological kind of questions are the big ones.
Yeah, because it is kind of,
you know, one.
Go ahead, Dan.
Sorry. Well, no, one thing I'd point out is that you can make it look like a telephone call, is my sense. Like, you just put it, you don't have to hold it out in front of you like a Star Trek device. so you can make it look like you're talking to someone on the phone. But can I make one interesting point here? And I'll put this in the show notes. But I read a really interesting article on the issues with GPS and museums. So GPS signals, I didn't know this, but you can't get them inside, or if you get them, they're really, really poor. They're nowhere near good enough to tell a phone when you're, for instance, standing in front of a Vermeer versus the painting next to it, or even down the hall, or even in another wing of the building. Again, I'll link to this post, but there's a good post over on I think the O'Reilly Radar about the issues that museums are going to have with these kinds of devices. And GPS. So the whole idea that you could suggest somewhere else to go, it may not be able to tell exactly where you are. And that's, again, where I think this very powerful three-way combination only works in some cases. And that's where, I guess, my understanding of this is that that's why these reminders are done at a kind of grosser level of granularity, where it's like when you arrive at your office building, well, it understands that you're at your office building, but it can't really understand when you get to your specific office within the building. And I wonder if that's going to impact the possibilities for this, that maybe it'll be great for that tour of the Civil War battlefield, but maybe it won't work inside of a museum.
Or if you're on the 27th or 49th floor.
Right. No. And right. And GPS can't, right, doesn't have the altitude, although there's other ways of figuring out those things, but we don't need to get into that.
Dan's office is actually on the 72nd floor of the Center for History and New Media, just so everybody knows. He's way up there.
The penthouse.
That's right.
Right. So, so I think it still remains to be seen how this is going to, you know, have an impact on the humanities. But I do think that these kinds of things, you know, I think we're going to see more and more of them. And I mean, I can't imagine that Google doesn't have something similar to this, given that it's really algorithm driven. Just kind of waiting to come out. And I think the Android app that will be similar will appear shortly, and then we'll see some more competition on this. And speaking of competition, Tom, you as we were discussing the podcast, you mentioned that an alpha version of Windows 8 is floating around. Have you had a chance to take a look at it?
I actually did install it and played around with it a little bit. I mean, it's a developer's preview, so really... yeah, and it is open to the public, and you can download it if you Google, Windows 8 developers preview. You can just go grab it, which is pretty kind of remarkable. Microsoft has done this in the past, but I mean, it's very early in the development cycle. We probably won't see Windows 8 until kind of late 2012. But they put this out there really just for that, for developers, so that developers could start. I think all of the APIs and stuff are in place, so developers can start building applications. But the rest of it is kind of half-baked. I mean, the really interesting thing about it, if you download the software and play with it for a little while, is how radically different the UI is. There's a new UI that Microsoft has developed called the Metro interface. And if you've ever seen a Windows phone, that uses a Metro-style interface. And it's based on, rather than on icons and kind of, you know, like a desktop. It's based on what they call tiles. And there's a good video that you can watch, too, if you don't want to bother downloading the preview. There's a couple of good videos out there. And it really is. I mean, it's what they call a touch-first interface. And it's something that they're going to deploy across all of their devices. So it's going to be one operating system, effectively, certainly one UI for phones, tablets, desktops, and laptops. It's going to be able to, you're going to be able to use it with your finger, with a mouse, with a keyboard. You're going to be able to with a stylus. And they're trying to come to a single UI for all of these different form factors, hardware form factors, and kind of use cases. And it really is interesting. I mean, it looks very cool. You know, of course, in the demos, they make it look really cool. Right now, using hardware built for Windows 7 and and with a very early preview, it's a little frustrating. And in a lot of the metaphors and stuff, it's going to require a lot of relearning on the part of users. But this is their new interface. I mean, this is the new Windows, and it is radically different. And I would say that it's, you know, without a doubt the biggest change to the desktop UI since Mac OS X. It's probably the biggest change since Windows 95, and it's possibly the biggest change to the desktop OS UI since the original Macintosh. I mean, it's a very different kind of, and it, you know, it's hard to talk about UI on an audio podcast. I encourage people to go take a look at it, but I think it's going to really affect.
Is there a release date for Windows 8?
There's not a firm release date, but the speculation is that it'll be ready and on the shelves in time for holiday season 2012, so a year from now, basically.
Because I have to say, I was really impressed with Windows 7. I've been a Windows hater for a long time, and then Windows 7 came out, and I thought, well, yeah. But both of my kids' computers are Windows 7 computers, and it was a really significant upgrade, and I had to kind of step back and say, okay, I can't be a hater anymore. This is a good product. And so if Windows 8 is that kind of additional upgrade, then that's really, that speaks really well for all of their developers.
Well, I mean, what's interesting is how disorienting it is. And yeah. Microsoft has never really been in the business of disorienting its customers. I mean, it makes billions and billions of dollars from, you know, the General Dynamics Corporation buying 100,000 desktop licenses and keeping things the same kind of over time. You know, I suppose that's why, and it's my understanding, maybe you can confirm this, Tom, that kind of one of the tiles is in some sense the old desktop, right? You can sort of launch the, you know, more standard file desktop metaphor.
Right. All of the there will be backwards compatibility with even Windows XP applications. So, right.
Yeah. They sort of had to do that with the old Microsoft, but it's rather gutsy. I mean, it's striking me that in an odd way, they're just not getting that much attention. Apple has really so dominated the past few years that I can't remember. I think I mentioned it on a prior podcast a couple months ago, but you know, I have a nephew who's, you know, he's in his teens and he's really into software development. And he's written an iOS app for music shuffling. But he's like most intrigued by this Metro interface. He has a Windows Phone 7, whatever it is. Windows Phone 7? My gosh, they're horrible with naming. Yeah, with this tile interface, he's really excited about upgrading it to 7.5, this new Mango thing. And he just really, there's a lot to it, I think, that's really intriguing to him. And I think we should give them a lot of applause for this. I just think it's sort of interesting to think about, can Microsoft be in the business of disorienting their consumers? For instance, in higher ed, is Mason going to upgrade its many hundreds of computers in the computer clusters to this new interface, and what will happen to students and faculty who are trying to use it, and will they understand what's going on? And
right, I mean, it really is bold, and I think that's in some respects why it's. I think people don't really know how to get their head around this, because it is. It's like right, like you know, still 90%+ of computers run on Windows, and like, and they're are they all really going to run this like brand new thing? It's and I think it's kind of hard to believe that they will. But Windows is, I mean, Microsoft is saying, this is Windows. This is it. That we've made this decision. We're going to take that gamble of disorienting, you know, several hundred million installed users.
Well, and it seems like such a huge bet on tablets as well. And they're really, there are not any particularly well-known, terrific-selling Windows tablets right now. So it seems as though, you know, if they're doing a touch-first OS, that seems to, you know, think it suggests that Microsoft is thinking that Windows tablets are going to be a big deal.
Well, it's going to be very interesting to see how this turns out. I mean, I think we're all encouraged, and I'm especially interested to see what the developers are going to start to come up with to you know set alongside these various tiles.
Right. If I could just say one more thing in that connection, I actually do think that this is going to be, you know, this is important for developers in a very specific way, and actually important for educational and digital humanities developers as well. I mean, one of the things that I don't think, especially maybe on the ed tech side, they've done a bit more of this, but certainly on the digital humanities side, we haven't done very much at all of. Almost all of our work is on the web because, you know, writing compiled applications in C++ or C# or these languages is pretty difficult. It's generally kind of above our technical competencies. Windows 8 is going to, I mean, the core language for writing these tiled applications, core languages are JavaScript, HTML5, JavaScript, and CSS. You're going to write these, you know, desktop applications, like full-blown Windows desktop applications, in these what are currently web technologies. That I think is pretty exciting, that you'll be able to use the skills that you already, as a, you know, self-trained digital humanist, know to write a desktop application that can run on a billion computers. That's pretty exciting, and I think that's definitely something we should look out for.
Yeah. Thanks, Tom. The next story we want to take a look at is the most recent meeting of the Digital Public Library of America. Amanda, you were there and gave a paper, and you had a kind of a strong opinion about the DPLA in an earlier version of the podcast. What can you tell us about the conference?
Yes, the DPLA plenary meeting took place, I think, exactly two weeks ago. We're recording this on November 4th. I believe I'm correct in saying that. And yes, at our end of year podcast, end of 2010, I specifically said that I thought that not much would come out of the Digital Public Library of America initiative in 2011. And that plenary meeting showed me that I was, in fact, very wrong. Because even at that meeting, I think a number of things happened and came out of it. The first thing is just to say that there is a good bit of momentum. So there's that. There's momentum. There's interest. There's an organization that is doing a lot of work. You know, at the Berkman Center, there are, you know, people who are devoting essentially all of their time to this. But the really exciting thing at the DPLA plenary was that they ran this beta sprint that we had actually talked about a few episodes ago. And again, I voiced fears that proved totally unfounded. I said, I'm not sure that people will compete in this, given that there's no prize and there's no guarantee that, you know, your thing will win. But we saw just the featured products from the beta sprint. And really, all of those products, I thought, were interesting and worthwhile just in and of themselves. Now, how exactly all of the beta sprint projects we saw will get integrated in the DPLA, people don't know that yet. And there is no specific governance structure or anything like that for the DPLA. But we saw a number of things demonstrated that are already really interesting. So just for instance, one of the very first things that was demonstrated was basically some people from the Smithsonian, from the National Archives, and the Library of Congress had gotten together and built a proof of concept sort of aggregation of content from all of those three places. So those are three enormous repositories that until now have been completely separate, completely siloed. And what they did was sit down and work out a way in which, you know, for a certain subset of content from all of those institutions, you can search through all of those. And that's actually that's a big deal, getting all that data to work together. We saw, coming out of Harvard, a couple of really great great things. One that was much more on the sort of front end, the user interface end, rather than the back end, was I've just forgotten the name of it. What was that thing, Dan? The really like remix suite type of thing that they came up with.
Extramuros.
Extramuros. Thank you. Yeah. So this was a beautiful kind of mix and mash type of user interface where you could take a lot of this data once it's been pulled together on the back end and really do interesting and beautiful looking things with it. And I won't even go into all of the other ones, but suffice it to say that there are a lot of really interesting products shown. And I think that even if in the still possible, but I would say at this point unlikely event that the Digital Public Library of America goes nowhere, I think that there are a number of products and projects that will stay alive, even if they don't get integrated into the DPLA. So I was really interested. I was really excited, and I thought it was a good meeting. And we're going to see, stick around and see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, I was at the meeting too. And first of all, we should give kudos to Amanda, who gave a terrific talk about the emotions that libraries engender and how this digital library itself will hopefully and should engender those same kinds of, the love of reading and knowledge. And she advocated strongly for it having a kind of physical presence, which I thought was a really interesting idea. I'm on the audience subcommittee, I guess you could call it, that's looking at sort of who's going to use this Digital Public Library of America. And there are quite a few public librarians who, really push for that idea that it has a kind of place, which, perhaps may not be a single building, but would be, part of each public library that could be devoted to or dedicated to, showing people that there's this huge virtual library behind the, few thousand volume little library in your town. I do think that Amanda's right. I think what this meeting really got across was that something's going to happen. I'm very convinced of that. I mean, in part, it's because they got $5 million or announced $5 million from the Sloan Foundation and from the Arcadia Fund, which is a lesser known foundation based in UK. They've got $5 million to work with. Of course, I think a real Digital Public Library of America, much like its closest parallel, which is Europeana, which we've talked about before on the podcast, the European Cultural Heritage Site, which has, I think, a couple million digitized objects from many countries and museums and libraries in Europe. That Europeana is a $1 billion project. So, it costs a lot to mount and sustain these things and to scan things in. So $5 million in that realm is not a lot, but, look, there are very impressive people involved with this project. Robert Darton, the university librarian at Harvard, who's also a well-known historian, I think he gives it a sort of intellectual and sort of public leadership that's important. John Palfrey and Maura Marks at the Berkman Center are really giving terrific on the ground, pragmatic, but and energetic leadership that is going to be really crucial. And I was really impressed with the people on some of these subcommittees. Technical Working Group has just a really impressive array of people who I am quite convinced can pull this off. So I think something will happen. My sense is that in the spring of 2013, there'll be some kind of beta launch of something. But I think the big question mark that came out of the meeting is what that thing is. And I think there are still some very important unresolved, I guess we could call them tensions. I think there are tensions, right? I brought up one earlier. You know, if it's a public library, is it servicing what public libraries do in communities, which, as we heard in the audience group, you know, 80% of the circulation of the average public library is, you know, the most popular kind of genre fiction books. It's not the million volume public domain books that right now we could mount as a digital public library of America, but would consist of, you know, Victorian, you know, rare Victorian books that most people don't read. So if we're going for that publicness, the fact that it's in some way an enhancement of the public library, you know, what are we putting in there? The legal and business groups were a little flummoxed, I think, about, you know, could they get digital copies of the latest John Grisham book into the Digital Public Library of America? Probably not. And if it doesn't have those books, the very high circulation recent books, is it a failure? I don't think so. But it's, you know, it's one of those questions that I think is going to be addressed. So there's a lot of moving pieces here. Some of them relating to business and legal questions like copyright, some of them relating to content, some of them relating to the technical questions of, you know, is the DPLA a giant server in the sky with all these volumes, or is it just a search engine that returns pointers to digital collections across America or perhaps even across the world? There's a lot to be resolved in the next 18 months, but I am convinced that something will happen and it likely will be rather good.
Yeah, I wanted to mention a couple things too. First of all, my talk is on my blog at amandafrench.net. And even though I feel like I've staked out this position a little bit of, you know, there should be a building, I'm the opposite of convinced that there will be a building, and certainly not anytime soon. I really think that my larger point, kind of as you suggested, Dan, is just that it should be more than a website. You know, somehow, even Europeana is a terrific resource. But I really think that everybody is kind of feeling like this needs to be something that's competing with Google and Amazon, which just began lending ebooks, as we talked about a couple of podcasts ago today, to Prime members. I am encouraged by this notion that, you know, that the more than a website could include any number of things. One of the things it could include is being a strong lobbying organization for policy change. And on that note, it's also encouraging to note that just on Wednesday, November 2nd, the Copyright Office issued a report outlining issues surrounding mass digitization of books. It was really a report sort of commenting on the Google Books ongoing lawsuit. But one of the things that was really notable for our community in that report was that it actually includes language, and I'll quote from it here. Congress may want to consider whether the nation's federal cultural institutions, the Library of Congress, the Smithsonian Institution, and the National Archives, should have a specific role in developing a national framework for mass book digitization projects. So that's one of the things that the DPLA is doing, could be doing, may well do. Like, in addition to just being a website, you know, building a really cool website, it could turn into a mass digitization project. And it could turn into a mass digitization project that demands new rules for making those digitized books available. So I have to say, even though I do still think a building would be cool, there are lots of ways in which the DPLA could be more than just a website. And that's one of them.
Well, on the and just as an addition, I've been thinking, I saw that notice also, and I thought, okay, and yet another complication in the Google Books process. And it made me think that, you know, I'm planning to retire in like 12 to 14 years, something like that. And I've got $10 that says this that lawsuit will still be going.
You can read Charles Dickens's Bleak House now, I'm sure, you know, which is all about.
Maybe we should put a counter on the Digital Campus website that says, you know, how many days and hours since the Google Books lawsuit was first launched.
How many days and hours since has it been since we last talked about it?
Right.
That's every.
I just have this like mental image, or I guess mental audio, of like, you know, all of us tired, like, welcome to Digital Campus 484. Today, the Google lawsuit again. And also Mill's retirement. Congratulations.
Right. Yeah. And the thing is, if we've mentioned the Google lawsuit that many times, for sure we'll have no listeners. So so we can talk about whatever we want at that point. Another story that came up in the news since our last podcast was comes out of the world of open access, discussions about open access and closed access journal publishing. And a couple of bloggers pointed out that they looked at the profits of Elsevier Corporation that publishes lots of journals in the STEM disciplines, and also Springer Corporation the same, and concluded that the profits, mind you, not the just annual turnover, but the profits from academic journal publishing from these two companies exceeded $2 billion, which begs the question of, why are the four of us in the humanities? But in addition to that, it also begs the question of, what's going to happen with open access? I mean, if companies are just two companies, and they're admittedly at the top end of the market in terms of the number of journals they control and all of that, but they're taking out of academia essentially $2 billion a year, money that could be spent on lots more research, money that could be spent on open access. You know, what does this mean? And one of the people writing about this pointed to the Public Library of Science, which is publishing on a fee for article basis, charging around $1,300. Now these are we have to all remember that these are, you know, medical, engineering, hard science articles and journals, but at about $1,300 per article. But they concluded that the $2 billion a year that Springer and Elsevier make in profits would finance all academic journal publishing if academic journals were charging everybody $1,300 per article. So clearly something's gotten a little out of whack here, especially in the humanities, where the cost per article is, you know, negligible. You know, where journals aren't charging authors yet. But Dan, you've had a lot to say, and recently we had a conference on campus about open access. Do you see these stories about the kind of insane profits?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I tweeted out some of these links, and, you know, obviously I think people, regular listeners of the podcast, know where I stand on this. I mean, I think these are exorbitant podcasts. I'm not opposed to profits, but, you know, the fact, I think even beyond the profits is the fact that year after year, these are companies that can raise their rates. They raise the amount of money they charge for these journals every single year, almost without fail. I think in 2009, they had like a brief pause. And, you know, I suppose they're not monopolies, but they're very close to it. I mean, I was part of this open access talk. There was someone from the econ department here at Mason who was saying, well, it's a free market, you know, open access venues should just compete and we should see who wins. And, you know, my point was that, you know, once scholarly journals are established, they have brands that almost are impossible to topple. You know, it's just very, very hard. It's not an easy business to break into. And
yeah, who's going to replace, you know, I think nature, you know,
right, nature or science, right? So I think it's much more complicated than this guy was trying to claim. And you know, I think the other factor making this more complex is the real divide between the humanities and the sciences. I mean, I almost like spit out my coffee when the two people who were there, one from Biomed Central, the very large aggregator of biomedical research, open access biomedical research, which is of course exists because the NIH mandated in their grants that all the research was made open access. And then someone from APS, the Scholarly Society of Physicists, who was talking about, you know, there's $60 million a year that they spend on their journals, like Physics Review A through E. And how it's just, you know, it's not a problem because, you know, scientists, they have $1,500 lying around to submit with a journal article to get it processed by Physics Review A. And, you know, I mean, it was laughable that we'd be able to come up with $1,500 to submit an article to the American Historical Review. So it's a different realm, and I think it's a confusing realm. I think what I was trying to get across was, you know, if you look at the overall economic landscape of this, almost all of the work is borne by faculty members, right? That the cost of an article, almost the entirety of the cost of the article, doesn't come on the editorial or the publishing side. It's the hidden cost of the salary of the faculty member writing the article, and then the often free peer review given to that article by other faculty members, and you know, some much more visible direct cost that's made to whatever process and, you know, format and disseminate it. But basically these companies are in, you know, the catbird seat. They're leeching off of all this free labor. They sell the products back at to universities based on library budgets every single year. Librarians often accede to these raises because faculty members want the journals. You know, it's a horrible system. It's not a system that, given the web today, if we had the web, we started out with the web, there's no way we would come up with this system. But I'm finding that it's, you know, incredibly hard to change. And it's very frustrating when you see these financial reports where, you know, last year, University of California really got frustrated because these big companies were charging them more and more every year. And they said, you know, no more, we don't want this. And, you know, these companies make up these things like, oh, but we have more journals this year and they're more expensive to produce. But the financials on it are clearly in the favor of the Reed Elseviers of the world. So I just don't get how massive change is going to come to this that easily.
I would just if I could add, I agree, Dan. And if I could just add one, take sort of one step back, in your analysis and say that not only is the bulk of the costs borne by you know, faculty labor free, that's provided free to the journals, I would say that most of that cost is actually paid by the taxpayer. I mean, it's almost entirely public money. It's almost more so in the sciences. I mean, whether it's you work for a state university, which many of the authors do and many of the peer reviewers do, or you are paid by federal grant funds from NIH or NSF or NEH or IMLS or wherever your grant money is that is used to perform the research, or even if you work at a small private liberal arts college and most of the revenues are provided by government subsidized student loans to the students. I mean, however you slice it, this is public money that's being spent to support the bottom line of these private corporations, and that I think is where you know, if there's any political case to be made, I think that's probably the strongest case, that like in these tough economic times where we can't get the power back on in Connecticut, your tax dollars are going to subsidize these exorbitant profits on behalf of these private journal companies.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point. This econ professor who's a libertarian was saying, well, you know, it's awful to get the government involved with scientific research because they will influence the kind of research that's done. And, you know, I had to sort of bite my tongue. I mean, almost all basic science research and medical research is funded by NSF and NIH. So it's already that way. I don't see how you can have a purely libertarian view of the situation. You know, it just doesn't exist. I mean, we can't make that exist. Sorry, Mills.
I was going to say that. The to me, the interesting piece in all of this, the way that the two of you have just described it, is that the universities around the United States and around the world are actually in a very strong position without realizing it. And that is, I mean, imagine if the flagship university systems in the United States all said, okay, we're not paying this anymore. that journal that costs $5,000 a year or $8,000 a year to subscribe to, we'll knock a couple of zeros off. How about, you know, $50 a year or $500 a year? Oh, that's not good enough? Okay, we can live without that. And we'll just encourage our faculty to start publishing in, you know, in open access journals. And we will reward them in promotion and tenure, which is what one of the reasons that faculty members care so much about these top tier journals. We will reward them in the same ways. And because we're just simply not going to pay this money anymore. And why are we not going to pay this money anymore? Because people in the legislature are breathing down our necks about our budgets. And so there's a solution. And so what is, you know, what are these big companies going to do when the people who are producing their content for them refuse to buy it back?
Well, and the problem with that is that it's got to be everybody all at once, almost, it seems like. You know, nobody wants to be the first to say no.
It's a game of chicken, really.
But it, mean, you know, there's a model in higher education in a completely different context, and that is that there's another big cash cow in higher ed, and that's called the College Board. And the SAT score monopoly, I mean, it's not a monopoly because there's also the ACT score, but that's a whole different company running that, but that testing process. But you know, increasingly, colleges and universities around the United States are not requiring their students to submit SAT scores for admission anymore. And it was very difficult to be one of the first to do that, but more and more every year are signing on to that process. Now, the students are still submitting their SAT scores because they think it might, if they think it might help, or they worry that if I don't submit it, they'll think I'm no good. But George Mason is one of those schools that doesn't require students to submit an SAT score. And that was just unthinkable 5 or 6 years ago that a university would not require that. But the number of schools every year not requiring that basic standard for college admission is growing. So it's possible. We just need a few people to get it started.
One of the big problems is, I mean, I think it is a classic prisoner's dilemma or whatever the correct dilemma is from Econ 101. But it's the secrecy part of this, that a lot of these big companies, when they make a deal, you know, $1 million deal to provide 1,000 journals to the University of California, they put in clauses that make it impossible to actually pull up that contract. So it's often very hard to find out what different universities are paying for their journal contracts. There's not a list price. These are all negotiated. They're secret. They're very, very hard to find. And so I think just a little bit of sunlight on the process. And of course, faculty bear an enormous responsibility because they're, in effect, implicitly acceding to this by just saying, well, I want Physics Review A. I don't care how much it costs. Or, you know, they don't participate often in the library budget decisions. They just think it's sort of something that happens without them.
Yeah, I think that's one of the main problems, even more maybe than the sunlight issue, is just that the people who are using and consuming this content and the people who are, you know, for the most part, producing it for free don't have to pay for it themselves, you know, and not only don't have to pay for it, but have no idea how much it costs, you know, to the point where you really still I definitely get the sense that most people do not understand that this is a problem. You know, I feel like I've been talking about the scholarly communication crisis for years, you know, probably 7 years, and it's been going on for longer than that. But the number of scholars who are aware of it in any real way, I think, is very low. If you know, my colleagues in literature, you know, to them, if there's a scholarly publishing crisis, it's that they can't get published. You know, they can't get their monograph published. And I don't think that they realize how much this journal situation has to do with that. You know, if you're going around shopping your book manuscript to a bunch of university presses and they can't afford to buy it because they know that it won't sell copies to libraries, and the reason for that is that libraries can't afford to buy those monographs because they have to spend so much on these, you know, expensive journals. So, you know, yeah. But that's too torturous a path for people to realize.
Which again, I think puts the lie to the libertarian argument. You know, if the consumers of the product aren't have no tie to the cost of it. I mean, you know, that whole kind of market, you know, free market model, you know, it just doesn't exist. It's the people demanding these things don't pay the cost. So it breaks down on that level as well.
There's probably some economics term for that, too. We'll have to get somebody to tell us what that is.
Actually, that'd be good to get an economist on. We should do that.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Next podcast, The Economics of Academic Publishing. That'll bring in the listeners. But speaking of free, in the humanities, a new scholarly journal just launched. We don't often talk much about our projects at the Center for History and New Media on the podcast, but I think this one is
worth. Yes, we do.
Yes, we do.
We don't.
That's news right there. It's news to me.
But this one I think is worthy of mention because it falls into this category, and that's the Digital Humanities Now has just launched on 2 days ago. So, Dan, can you give a brief summary of what that is?
Well, it is a rebirth of, I hope, a already valued property that people will find again or resubscribe to. But
for free.
For free, digitalhumanitiesnow.org, your one-stop shopping for all things digital humanities. So, you know, I started with the help of Jeremy Boggs a couple years ago, a site that aggregated the kind of top articles and news in digital humanities on the site. It was based almost entirely on Twitter and what people were linking to on Twitter. But as we know, there are some people who are not on Twitter, and we wanted to
I
don't know. As part of a retooling, and folding it into our Press Forward initiative, which is looking at new ways of doing open access publishing that not only provide open access, but also provide levels of peer review and quality review, with the assumption that people only have a limited amount of time each day. And so we understand that, you know, they can't read everything on Twitter or on blogs, and we wanted to provide some reduced set of the best stuff. So it has been relaunched with a totally retooled back end, with the help of a lot of good people here at the Center for History and New Media, ranging from Joan Ferghese Troiano and Sasha Boni and Jerry Waringa, two graduate students, Jerry and Sasha, as well as our trusty webmaster, Ammon Shepherd, and design work by Kim Nguyen. And so we've relaunched it, I think, in a much better place, which is that it's now scanning about 400 different sites, feeds, blogs, institutional websites, conference websites for new and interesting and good content in digital humanities. And it now provides different ways to read it so that you can just get a very limited stream of what we call editor's choice, the best stuff in the left column. Then there's sort of breaking news like grant opportunities and jobs. Calls for papers, conferences in a middle column. And there's unfiltered ways to read it where you can, you know, really gain access to our entire back end and get the raw stream of hundreds of posts that we have to scan through every day. So it's a good place. Again, if people haven't seen it before, go to digitalhumanitiesnow.org or at DHNow on Twitter. And it's a really easy way to subscribe and get all the most important news and now the best scholarship in digital humanities.
Thanks, Dan. And I thought I would probably never say this, but whoever controls the Edwired Twitter account with my picture on it, would you email me? Thank you.
That is an important public service announcement because we always thought it was someone at the center, but evidently it's
but
not.
We just don't know whoever it is, or if it is somebody at the center, they're lying. So one last thing is that in talking to the folks that Dan just mentioned who are working on Press Forward, they're using Google Plus as their collaborative platform for part of the back-end editorial process. And I went out to Google Plus when it first appeared. Dan, Tom, Amanda, you're all there too. I'm still struggling to figure out for my own use how it's good or useful. Anybody else making, other than this editorial process that Sasha and Jerry have developed, which I can actually see how that works, anybody else using it at all?
No, I stopped. It really isn't anything against Google Plus. Per se, it's just that I just can't manage more than one social network, apparently. And I've chosen that to be Twitter, and that's about it. So at some point, I actually did do a Google Hangout the other day, which was fun and useful. But I think it's going to be, for me, like Facebook, where I go and use it when I need it, but not on a regular daily basis.
Dan, Tom, Google Plus guys?
Yeah, I mean, Dan and I, we just got it. And I, so far, I've been struggling with it because there's a certain amount of front-end cost to using Google Plus. I've got to put all my people in these circles, and maybe I'm overthinking it. I mean, which, you know, I tend to do, but you know, it's hard to decide. Okay, so Mills, you are a friend. You are also a work colleague. You're also in my digital humanities circle. You're also on, we do a couple projects together. So do those get their own circles? You know, I mean, deciding for every single person you know what your relationship is to them and whether that relationship, you know, so Amanda, you're also a friend, but are you the same kind of friend that Mills is? Well, I don't know. So should you be, I mean, making those decisions for every single person I know is, you know, is difficult. Whereas like Twitter, it's just everybody's in one pile and that's kind of that. And everything I post is public, and there it is. That I think has been my problem with Google Plus. Maybe that's sort of the same problem you have with Facebook. Although I think Facebook is easier too. It's like you're either friends with this person or not, and they either see your stuff or they don't. Making these kind of privacy distinctions and you know, just, you know, sharing distinctions for everybody you know is just, I think, a lot of overhead for a system. And I think I'm having a hard time getting past that.
Too much thinking. That's the problem.
Yes.
Too much thinking.
I enjoyed that part. I did that part. I just don't ever use it now that I've done it.
So you added all this information. You added all this value to Google Plus, and it's just lost.
Right. It actually cracked me up. There was that email that was going around a couple of weeks ago from Steve Yegg, who is a Google employee who wrote a very long memo, you know, in Google Plus about everything that was wrong with Google, which is essentially that, you know, none of its internal services talk to each other. And it was just kind of hilarious because he accidentally shared it publicly when he only meant to share it with his friends or whatever. And that was exactly what Google Plus was supposed to prevent. So I thought that was kind of funny.
Oops. Yeah. Well, on that cautionary note, we want to thank everybody for listening today. Thanks, Tom, Dan, Amanda, for being regulars on our podcast, and we'll talk to everybody soon.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do.